Okay, now we're going to talk for a minute. We're going to start. It always feels like it's doing it the first time every time. That is what I like about it, though.
You know, when you get really good at something.
Well, wasn't that what we were talking about writing the other day? Or we were making fun of somebody. Maybe we've already talked about this before, but like when I'm writing my novel, it's like every sentence is its own new struggle. It's like that's literally how I feel about it.
It's living in the now, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we're in a coal mine in Pennsylvania. You know, it's like, but yeah, it's just.
Well, you want to hear my story about living in the now?
Yeah.
This was my justification for it. So I'm driving to Seattle, and me and Stacy are going to take the long way, and we're going to go hang out in Spokane, because Spokane is kind of a gross, weird place.
Cool town,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
Cool town.
It's kind of cool. But so I get up to Butte, and instead of going west, I go east, because I'm just in the moment. You know, I'm just living in the moment. I'm like, okay, I got this. I drive east for 150 miles. 150 miles. that was a real good ego check there. It was like, if anything makes you go, okay.
Yeah. You're in the moment. What were you talking about?
We weren't talking about anything. I was just...
Yeah.
I just didn't notice and...
Well, I've told you about the greatest story ever was my son and his buddy left Pocatello to a bachelor party in Jackpot, Nevada. And right around Wendell, I think, they on the interstate, they lit up.
Yeah.
And turned left. Cross the bridge to Twin Falls, and it is kind of confusing. You go through, and then you go to Addison Avenue, old Highway 30, and you go east towards Buell.
Yeah.
And then about 4 miles out, there is a turn to Jackpot. They, of course, are having such a wonderful time talking that they just keep cruising right on, and pretty soon the road goes down through Buell, and then it goes down along the Snake River, and the Thousand Springs are gushing out, and Colin is going, geez, Jim, I had no idea this was such a beautiful drive to Hagerman, to the Jackpot. And I didn't know there was this big river here, man. This is fantastic. So, I mean, gosh, you talk about a great short story, man. But no, they just had a great time, because it's a very boring, you know, dull drive across the desert to Jackpot, and they made it really...
Interesting.
Really fun, man.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
Until they figured, you know, when they went up the hill to Bliss, oh, maybe we're not. And it said Boise, 100 miles. But yeah, oh. And the other really great one to make you feel even better was, strange how drugs is involved in this, but my good buddy Scott is heading in the middle of the night north from Salt Lake. And he does like amphetamines. And he's headed north of Pocatello. But the freeway, as you know, turns off at Tremont and
right.
goes north.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it goes onward to Twin Falls. And inquiring minds want to know why he went all the way through northern Utah, southern Idaho, Twin Falls, and was approaching Mountain Home when he thought, maybe I'm on the wrong. Well, I think he ran out of gas. That's what happened. And he gets on the old Oregon Trail Road. He's now like 20 miles from Mountain Home in the middle of the desert, 200 miles west of Pocatello, Idaho.
Yeah.
Before he kind of thought, maybe I took a wrong turn somewhere, which... Joan actually is an intro to our talk about the great writer Truman Capote. Where did this guy in Alcatraz take the wrong turn?
Well, yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. That it's yeah. In later in life, he got very interested in just writing about convicts. After In Cold Blood, he seems to have gotten kind of mildly addicted to it, or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. Like he was kind of a convict chaser.
But they got to know him in Alcatraz.
Yeah.
Yeah, they said, oh, yeah, that's Truman Doug.
I think it's San Quentin. Yeah.
Right, thank you.
Yeah. Alcatraz, I think, would have been more of a trek. It might have offended his sensibilities going on those salty boat rides. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, well, we can talk about it.
No, I was talking about the guy who was part of the Manson gang.
Yeah.
And where he took a wrong turn because he was a child actor, very popular. Women loved him. I have the book. He did a movie on Hollywood, and I have the book. This guy named Anger, and I had the book Hollywood
Kenneth
Babylon,
Anger.
And it's a damn good book, man.
Is it?
And so he Hollywood Noir, the inside story of what really happened in Hollywood. Yeah, I've got it in there somewhere. And but he also did a film with this guy. And,
yeah, or they had a proposed film. Okay.
And so you ought to give a little background to the story.
So Capote is interviewing Robert Beausoleil. That's how I'm going to pronounce his last name. Robert Beausoleil, who is now 31, is the real mystery figure. Excuse me. of the Charles Manson cult. More to the point. And it's a point that has never been clearly brought forth in accounts of that tribe. He is the key to the mystery of the homicidal escapades of the so-called Manson family, notably the Sharon Tate LoBianco murders. It all began with the murder of Gary Hinman, a middle-aged professional musician who had befriended various members of the Manson Brethren and who, unfortunately for him, lived alone in a small isolated house in Topanga Canyon, Los Angeles County. Hinman had been tied up and tortured for several days. Among other indignities, one of his ears had been severed, before his throat had been mercifully and lastingly slashed. When Hinman's body, bloated and abuzz with August flies, was discovered, police found bloody graffiti on the walls of his modest house. "Death to pigs!" Graffiti similar to the sort soon to be found in the households of Miss Tate and Mr. and Mrs. LoBianco. However, just a few days prior to the Tate-LoBianco slayings, Robert Beausoleil, caught driving a car that had been the property of the victim, was under arrest and in jail, accused of having murdered the helpless Mr. Hinman. It was then that Manson and his chums, in the hopes of freeing Beausoleil, conceived the notion of committing a series of homicides similar to the Hinman affair. If Beausoleil was still incarcerated at the time of these killings, then how could he be guilty of the Hinman atrocity? Or so the Manson brood reasoned. That is to say, it was out of devotion to Bobby Beausoleil that Tex Watson and those cutthroat ladies sallied forth on their satanic errands. Which, to me, is fascinating because it got so mixed up in this all other media mumbo-jumbo.
Mm-hmm.
And it took, you know, Capote to sit there and break it all down, and mm-hmm. I was like, I never knew that. I never knew they were supposed to mimic to get this other guy out of jail. I never really understood that.
Right. And our listeners have to read this creative nonfiction piece, reporting piece, because the final denouement is like spectacular. And I mean, it's really dramatic, and you're also really thinking, you know, for a little Nancy boy, he's got a lot of balls, man.
Yeah, he's tough, yeah.
He's a tough little, you know, and then you think, yeah, well, fucking gay, I guess you better be tough, man.
Right, you're right.
But, no, the ending of it is unbelievable, and he pretty much, I'm not going to tell you the ending, because it's too good.
Well, they can look up the ending on Wikipedia if they want, but the ending to Capote's character piece, I mean, that's something different. How do you sum up a character piece in a soundbite? You don't. I mean, that's the beauty of a character piece. You kind of got to read it all in order to get a sense of the character. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The whole, you know, I've just been thinking a lot recently about how this guy was talking about Chet Baker and how he would just enter a song and just breathe and play and just sing the song, you know, in time, right? In the flow of time. And that's part of Capote's genius. In that interview, he just kind of gives you, you feel like it's a very natural flow of time between the questions of Capote to Beausoleil and how it all happens. And then all of a sudden it just kind of changes, and Capote really sets him up in this subtle way. If you were let out, would you kill somebody again? And for some reason, this triggers Beausoleil to kind of go, yeah, I didn't want, wasn't really thinking about killing Henman, but...
Well, his argument is anything that happens is good, right? It's like...
That goes through it.
Yeah, yeah.
That goes through it, but still, it was the question after all this, and you... And of course, Beausoleil is hyped up, and he's got his shirt off, and he's showing off his pecs, and, you know, how beautiful he is, and why women loved him, and why men loved him.
Yeah.
And he's also an Aryan Nation, part of the Aryan Nation.
Yeah.
And he makes clear, too, how a lot of the Aryan Nation white supremacists came out of prisons where they were threatened by the black populace, right?
Yeah.
Fascinating piece, man.
Yeah, really good.
And that's, you know, you ask, why did Capote become drawn to that? Well, you know, for a long time, homosexuality was a criminal act, right? And there's always this... this taint of criminality to
right.
it.
Well, he also had a very troubled childhood.
That's true.
And I return to the Capote movie,
which I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, I'm pretty good on it, but I'm not perfect. But there's this, the line in the Capote movie that I rewatched actually a few weeks before picking this book up. Maybe it probably influenced me to do so, which actually has a weird lie at the end. It says after In Cold Blood that he broke down and he never wrote anything else. And he's writing these character pieces in the late 70s. I mean, he was still writing. He was still doing all kinds of stuff. So that movie is imperfect, is what I'm saying. But it has this one of these great lines where he's talking to his friend. Well, in the movie, it's played by Harper Lee. And she comes out to visit him. And he says, you know, I get the distinct feeling talking to these men that, or specifically... the one he got most obsessed with, the Indian guy in Cold Blood, Native American guy, sorry, who he was like, I feel like we had the exact same childhood, and he walked out the back door and I walked out the front door. And I think that's...
Well, Gilmore's were Mormon.
Right. No, I'm talking about the guys who killed the Gilmores.
Okay, now...
In Cold Blood.
In Cold Blood. Okay, I'm getting my... I think I'm getting my my murder's mystery, but I thought the Gilmores were... So, I thought they were too. Anyway, it is a Mormon story. It is a Utah story, right?
Well...
So, yeah.
No, you're thinking of Gary Gilmore. You're thinking of the... Which he actually makes a reference to later in... that's Mailer's. That's Mailer's nonfiction novel. Gary Gilmore is from the Hangman's Song.
Interesting. Gosh, now I got to go back and read Cold Blood. Okay, so onward and upward. Since I've we can edit this out for certain.
Well, sorry, I kind of jumped between things without knowing you'd be aware of it. I assumed too much.
Right.
Anyway, I thought it might explain part of his fascination with killers, especially after, I mean, because...
Well, I think that's a good point, Jonah, is that, yeah, repressed anger and seeking out people who actually acted out their anger.
Mm.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, it's a great piece. He's a wonderful technician, and I remember his line about Kerouac... he just types, right?
Yeah.
And Capote's always got this kind of gem-like balancing where every word matters. I mean, this is so-called creative nonfiction. Every word matters in both those pieces. One and the one, A Day's Work, geez, there's not one word extra, man. It's so spectacular.
Right.
And the way it unfolds. And the other thing I got to say about these are all in
Music for Chameleons.
Music for Chameleons, and they're just two little non-fiction creative pieces, and just spectacular. But both of them are very beautifully controlled, and both of them just kind of like open up before your eyes, you know.
Yeah.
Just like a flower, man. A compression and opening up is just amazing. No, I was astounded by him, really.
Well, and he's got that interesting natural essence of taking an image that is a natural metaphor, because Music for Chameleons, which is I think is a great title, because it's kind of for writers, right? It's like a writer is partially a chameleon, right? It's kind of got a double meaning there. It's music for people who try and blend in and listen and talk to other people. You know, it's got a writerly essence to it, but it's also literal. It's about him going to Martinique, and he's visiting this dapper lady. I don't know how he meets all these like upper class people, and you know, he's got all these stories about celebrities and stuff. I don't know how one does that. I don't know how much work is involved with that or how much luck. I don't know. But anyway, she's playing her piano. She's playing Mozart in her piano, and like five or six different colors of chameleons cover the floor of her drawing room. They come in from outside, and they just love listening to the music. And then as soon as she's done, she stamps her foot, and they all go fleeing out the door again. And it's such a beautiful image, and it's also, you know, it's kind of got that subtle metaphorical essence to it.
Yeah, well, the primary reality is so beautiful, though. I mean, they're just basically chameleons like music.
Yeah, right. Which is weird in its own way.
So, as you know, I've been reading Barry Hanna.
Yeah.
Yonder Stands the Orphan with His Gun. Well, guess what? It's about Vicksburg. And there is a Highway 61 that runs through Vicksburg.
What's the significance of Highway 61?
Bob Dylan.
Oh, yeah.
Yonder stands the orphan with his gun, crying like an orphan in the sun. Look out, babe, they're looking after you. Stuff like, I mean, all the songs kind of verge on that. But yeah, Joan and I were talking about John Kennedy Toole. And Southern gay writer, ostensibly. Barry Hanna, I'd heard was. Jonah heard Toole was. I hadn't heard Toole was. And Jonah hadn't heard Hanna was.
Yeah.
So there you go. So we only have the queen up there at the top, you know, and the master of them all, really. You know, you got to say that. And
Capote, you mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. But Barry Hanna, I'm just getting through with it. I mean, and he is taking Confederacy of Dunces to the absolute limit of Fellini-like extravagance of violence and madness. I mean, it's just incredible, man. But could he ever have done it without Confederacy of Dunces? I don't think so, man.
That's interesting. I don't know. So this is a very weak tie-in, but I'll reiterate. We're doing two gay Southern writers. But also, I just picked up Confederacy of Dunces again, and I got some real like esoteric questions I just want to lob in your direction.
Great.
and see what you think. Okay. So my copy of the Confederacy of Dunces says it won the Nobel Prize. Oh, no, sorry. Pulitzer Prize. Jesus. That beer caught up to me quicker than I thought. But...
What are you drinking there?
Wanderland.
And this is out of Sierra Nevada.
Yeah.
So we're drinking to Sierra Nevada today because they're supporters of environmental issues and trout streams and all that.
Yeah, that's right.
And apropos of that, we have to tell you that the Big Wood River, fabled, flowing through the most beautiful, rich country in the earth where everybody wants to fly fish, the upstream irrigators with their 50 acres had drained it dry 2 weeks ago. It's dry.
Oh, wow.
And although, if you want to go to Sun Valley, Idaho and fly fish, well, don't go south of Sun Valley. Maybe they've pumped a little water in there. But yeah, best use. So back to Tool.
Okay. So Tool tries to publish his book, Confederacy of Dunces. He can't. He doesn't get anybody. He falls into despair and kills himself at 32 in like a bathtub in St. Louis or something.
Oh, God.
And then for like another decade, his mother sits on the manuscript. She brings the manuscript to Walker Percy, who is working at Southern University.
He's also gay.
Is he?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that.
But that's what we think about Southerners who talk with that funny accent, you know. They're all gay, apparently, unless they're, like, got shotguns and want to shoot you. Isn't this a strange dichotomy for us Northerners? We must assimilate this. Somehow we must do this. That would be the great play that you got to write. A bathtub in St. Louis. Because, I mean, after all, man, Confederacy of Dunces is such a joy to read, man.
Yeah. God.
Yeah.
So the mother. His despair comes from no recognition or whatever. I mean, I get it on a certain level. I mean, I totally get it. But on another level, I'm like, well, I don't know. That's just reality.
And he had a job teaching.
Did he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he taught. He was in the...
Well, that would make sense, because he seems to know academia very well and Confederacy of Dunces. There's something about Confederacy of Dunces that I feel like could be updated to today. Like, there's... Because it's got all these funny little jabs at academic mindsets, mm-hmm. and, like, these characters out of academia, and, like, just... proposing them as these kind of really ridiculous comic figures, and I'm like,
right,
there's a new novel in that. Yeah, there's somebody has to write that novel, yeah, right? But the only problem is you couldn't get it published because the only people who are publishing it are the people in academia. So who's gonna be interested in seeing a satire about themselves?
Unless you're a tenured professor in creative writing.
Well, yeah.
That's well, that's again, you know, you now we get in this subtext of novels that are hiding a certain thing, because there's nothing in, I mean, the hero of Confederacy of Dunces is pretty far away from being in academia,
yeah, yeah.
Right?
He was only involved. He went to graduate school, but yeah.
But he's still, he's got the inside knowledge, and I mean, we find that fascinating, because as a deconstructionist would find this very interesting. I'm just saying that that part of the great humor in it is this knowledge, right? But obviously nothing in the novel has much to do with it.
Yeah, yeah, but, not the system at large.
But anyway, I mean, why? Bathtub in St. Louis. Why would he kill himself? He's got a job in academia. Well, people are saying, well, yeah, I've worked as an adjunct professor. I've tried to get tenure. Yeah, I know why I want to kill myself. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're so.
And that might.
Pardon the introduction.
Yeah. Okay. So. Anyway. He gets published, and then in 1980 or 81, it wins the Pulitzer. Now. Convince me I am not a ridiculous cynic that somebody at the publishing company realized that they could publish a book that already had like a tragic backstory, and they submitted it, because why would you give a Pulitzer to somebody who's dead? It doesn't make any sense, right? Because they're already dead. So who are you giving the Pulitzer to? Where does it exist? Does the book itself deserve the Pulitzer, or does... Like, this is my... Because there's two parts of my brain. There's one part that goes, okay, it's just a cynical manipulation of the public to buy the book that they're publishing for themselves. But there's also the other part of me, it's like, well, I suppose it sort of deserves it. But then, if it does sort of deserve it, doesn't it also sort of convince another generation of writers? It's like, well, you know, if you really want to win a Pulitzer, maybe you should just kill yourself. I mean, if you want your name to last on a little longer, then maybe it should, you know.
Well, again, I mean, that's what's so glorious about literature, because great literature is a mirror of reality. And here we have this little trap door of the reality of, I mean, Toole hides that he's an academic throughout the novel. And then basically the people who took it and promoted it are hiding the fact that, boy, we've got the classic selling point here. You know, I mean, people are going to cry about this forever, right?
Yeah.
And we gave the Pulitzer. I mean, this is a win-win situation. But I mean, I don't see it as totally, you know, binary. I mean, I think it's a win. It's a great book.
Well, obviously,
and we got a great selling point.
But
you
obviously,
know?
Toole didn't win, right?
I mean, no, it's not a, no. It's not I'm just saying that it's a win-win, as the locals say around here. It's a win-win situation. We got a great book, and we got a great selling point. You know,
right.
We can hawk this everywhere. How are they possibly going to not give the Pulitzer, and how, and look how many people are going to read this book,
yeah,
and how many people have, you know, and yeah, it's, this is, you know, this is why we enjoy literature so much, because there really are no frames. I mean, the frames are always, are quite ductile, you know, they're moving around, you're trying to get a handle on it, And how we could possibly find a hook like this for a podcast, I don't know, Jonah.
Yeah, just have some really pretentious...
well, if we got arrested, you know, we got busted for something, you know?
I'm telling you, officer, the frames are quite ductile.
We didn't mean to say this about the Pocatello police. It just came out, you know. I don't know, man. Yeah. No, here's the Pocatello police. They're quite a professional crew.
And there's so many of them too.
That's, you know, why they're so professional, man.
Yeah, it's like I guess they don't. They're not overworked or whatever.
Right, man. Well, it's a tough town, man. There are a lot of, you know, just like I was telling you about that day. I walked around the corner, and there's my good old friend, who shall remain unnamed, is running across the street where she's been drinking too much. And gets in between two police cars and a guy that's got his face down with, you know, the handcuffs, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the odds are it's Wes Pocatello. He's a parole breaker, or he's, you know, on a, there's a warrant, man. I mean, that's just the facts. It's called demographics, you know. And, you know, baby, I sympathize with you trying to protect his civil rights, but, you know, if they come up and said, you know, the judge wanted you to be in jail and you weren't there, and what are you going to do? And he says, hey, man, I'm sorry, but I'm not, you know, anyway, that's just how it is.
I feel incredibly safe in West Pocatello.
Right.
But I have also met two of the craziest individuals I think I've ever met anywhere.
Right.
There's one guy who I met that, like, you know when you get the meet the psychopath vibes and the hair tingles on the back of your neck, because
really?
You're just like, this guy is literally a psychopath.
You were sober then.
I think I was, yeah.
Beware of this, man. Beware of this.
Well, I mean...
well, maybe not.
I mean, what he did was literally psychopathic behavior.
Mm-hmm.
There was a girl that he liked that lived next door, and he was on his bicycle and he crashed. So he was like all bloody. His like knees were bloody and shit. And he was hanging out in the yard, and I stepped out, and he was all bloody all over the place. I'm like, oh shit, man. And he's like, yeah, I crashed my bike. And I'm like, all right, I'll bring you some gauze or whatever. And then he's like, and I'm like, can I take you to the hospital or something? He's like, no, I was just waiting for this girl. And I'm like, why? He's like, oh, because I know her. I thought she might. So I knock on her door. I'm like, you know this guy? And she's like, yeah, kind of. And then he's like, yeah, well, I'll go if she comes along with us. And then all of a sudden, once we're in the car, I'm driving. He's like, yeah, no, don't take me to the hospital. Let's just go back to my apartment. And then we stop. And he's like, hey, you guys want to come up and smoke some meth? And just the whole time, I was like, this guy is fucking... I mean, I see his play, right? His play was, I'm injured. I'm going to go to this girl's house, and she's going to be sympathetic to me. But that's how a psychopath thinks. It's just,
well, you had to admire, you know, the amount of sacrifice that he was willing to go through.
Yeah, yeah. Bone practically sticking out of his skin, and he's like, what? I mean, yeah, she's pretty, but it's not bone sticking out pretty.
Where can you get information like this, gentle listener? I mean, this is the real Pocatello. Yes. Oh, yeah.
That, and one night, okay, this is my second story. One night, I walked out of my apartment, and I was just going to go to the grocery store. And I think I'm, like, a little, you know, half-loaded already. And so I just walk out. I'm not really paying attention to anything. And all of a sudden, I hear footfalls behind me. And I turn around, and it's a guy in a full-on clown mask. And wearing on his back, he has a bow and arrow. That dangling from the end is a child's baby doll that's, like, hooked on there with a string. And I have a full moment where I just look at him, and I'm like, oof, that's quite the getup you're wearing, man. And he's like, yeah. You think so, right? Yeah, it's pretty good. And I turn and I keep walking and I keep looking over my shoulder, and he goes somewhere else, and I'm just like, Jesus, what the fuck was that?
So. This is why, you know, we're good writers. We don't really get that excited about anything. This is an aesthetic. You know, aesthetics have different, you know, this is what's called the relativity of aesthetics of the postmodern world, man. Yeah, yeah, certain of his iconography is, you know, oh man, yeah, yeah. Which is interesting that, yeah, so much of it is just not really false with these people. I mean, this is really,
yeah,
basically, this is not theater, man. This, yeah, is like,
you just take them at their word.
They're not actors. They, yeah, are like living their dream, so to speak. Yeah. And yeah, I don't walk down West Side so much. Ever since that guy started throwing asphalt at me, man, I was like, geez, man.
There's a guy that started throwing asphalt at you?
Yeah, well, I'm going down the alley because I don't like the exhaust from Maine. Yeah. So, gentle listener, if you don't know Pocatello, basically you've got the railroad tracks. You've got Main Street, and then you've got the alley away from Main Street. And all these people really don't like to go along the tracks because the Union Pacific dicks are there and are going to harass them, and the cops too. And so they go down the alley or like this. So, of course, this is where I like to go too because I don't like the exhaust on Main Street.
Yeah,
so anyway,
yeah, that's what I do too.
So I run into this guy, and... And I've just got a guitar. I've got a really nice golden guitar case, and I'm going down the street and going down the alley to play some music. And this guy comes toward me, and I smile at him, and he says something to me. I don't quite pick it up. And then he comes back, he starts throwing rocks at me. He's going. But see, he had seen the senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham,
yeah,
where he goes, "Not in my town. This is my town." That's exactly what he said to me. "This is my town." And then he starts fucking throwing rocks at me, man. I'm going, Jesus. I'm in the alley, and I don't want to put my nice guitar down, so I retreat down the alley, and I get across the street, and I put the guitar down on nice, clean asphalt, and the rocks are coming down, and then I go back after him, and then, of course, he turns and he starts running. Jesus, man. This is my town. Oh, my gosh, yeah, man.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, well, we're glad they're not in prison with Robert Beausoleil, you know?
Sure.
We're
nice tie-in. I appreciate that. we had really gotten real off course there. So that was good. That was real good. Yeah, I'm proud of you.
Yeah, it's easier on the taxpayer. Just yeah, just give him a little apartment on the west side.
Well, when I was in Spokane, me and because Spokane is kind of dirty, so me and Stacy went through a underpass, and we could tell there was quite a few homeless people living under there. And as soon as we get there, we start walking towards it, and there's a kid who comes around the corner. He's got a glass bottle, and he just fucking chucks it at the wall. He goes, whoosh. And I'm like, okay, maybe I shouldn't walk under this underpass if there's this guy who's just so uptight that he's willing to do that. But we power through and we go through. I mean, I'm not that scared of these kinds of people generally, except for people when they're incredibly in those high emotional stances, because then they can't be reasoned with by any normal means. But I was thinking to myself, like, it's, why are they huddled under this underpass? Like they're only, it's all, things are only going to get worse for them, right? When they're cornered like rats in this little area, like, go anywhere else. You know, it's like, you've got all day, go find a park or something. And like, but then of course the police would kick them out of it for being itinerants, and then beautiful parks just sit empty while, you know, we corner people like rats into places where they just get worse and worse. And it's just, I don't know, it doesn't really make any sense to me. I mean, obviously it's not totally the fact that they're cornered. Obviously that's only sort of tangential. They probably already have mental problems or whatever, or, you know, trauma or historical whatever, but there's also like, what are you doing just staying under this underpass all day? I don't get it at all.
Right. Well, you make again, you know, you make this is the second binary opposition that is a little bit of both, you know. And I had thought it was pretty much the latter, in terms of that they are, you know, kept out of the parks, right?
Yeah.
But again, I mean, there's got to be some draw to this environment,
right,
which is what they really want, and the fact that they actually feel somewhat comfortable there.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, because they're not alone, and they've got some backup or something.
Everybody's fucked up around them, and they're, you know, they're like, it's community, man.
Yeah.
So no, I think that's a great insight. I hadn't even thought about it myself.
Well, I hadn't thought about it.
If we could just widen our underpass here a little wider so we could get a little more room for people.
Well, last winter I saw a guy trying to make an impromptu fire under there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, this seems like a terrible idea, but I'm not going to stop you. I mean, it just seems goofy.
I've walked through that underpass, and I've seen people sleeping in garbage bags and with pit bulls. I mean, it is a place out of the rain, our underpass.
Yeah.
Our underpass is a noble underpass.
Yes.
It accepts all.
It's quite noble.
It's not that wide, you know, you got just enough room for people to walk by. I just think about how wonderful it is, Jonah. Again, just the privilege of being, I say that, if there are any ladies listening, the entitlement of being male and physical and being big and physical,
sure,
and being able to walk through underpasses without feeling any anxiety, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But if it makes, again, anybody feel better, every time I go into those places, yeah, I do feel a lot like, okay, what am I going to do, right? But if, God, cute little gal, 5'4", 120, looking good. Are you kidding me? Fuck. There's no way. There's no way. And
well, I mean, like 90% of the time she'd walk through and there'd be nobody else in there.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's the other thing. And it actually is my second novel. You know, I've talked to some little street gals, you know, and they're saying, hell, they don't have any problem. It's with these, you know, people that are living up on the hill in an unhappy marriage and are basically sociopaths, right? And what is more dangerous, the sociopath or the psychopath? It's the sociopath, man. Because they're working at INEL or fucking for the school district or whatever. and hiding the fact that they've got the spear with the dolls on it, you know. Right? I'm serious, man. I believe this totally. I'm totally with this. People on the street, they might be fucked up, but it's pretty obvious they are, you know. And yeah, there's really not much to hide. And anyway, I've had people tell me, you know, I don't worry about these people. It's when a guy pulls up in a nice car or a nice truck, says, "Hey, how you doing?"
Yeah.
That's what, you know, trips me.
Totally. Out. Yeah. Well, should we pause and see if we can get back on track into the actual books?
I think
books?
We're right with Capote, man.
We're good.
Hi, guys.
Hey, what's going on?
Here's what's interesting about Here's what's interesting about starting the second part of the podcast after a good sale for Will is the mediocreness of Walker Percy, who introduced Confederacy of Dunces to the world, is, as a pseudo-intellectual myself, I appreciated Walker Percy for a very brief time in my early 20s. Because he was definitely one of those guys who was on the verge of like trying to meld sort of physics details with pseudo-mysticism. And he wrote a book, and his breakout, The Moviegoer, which I don't know why I bring it up. I don't encourage anyone to read. It's weird to know a name. Is this part of the literary landscape? Is just to know a name, and then you're like, but I would never tell anyone to read anything by him. It's fine. It's like, but I think that's part of the thing of being interested in literature is you just read everything. It's like you're not going to take anybody else's word for it, right? You're just going to be like, I'll find out for myself. You know, that's kind of the beauty of it.
Right, but we all have a fascination for all these names because they escaped oblivion.
Right.
You know?
Right. And briefly.
By hook or by crook. Briefly.
Yeah.
And, Walker Percy is, nobody knows who he is. And I tried to read him. It was just like, I don't know. It's just, going back to the selling of Confederacy of Dunces, the fact that earlier I alluded to how much guts that Truman Capote has got. He goes to New York City, man. He gets a job with Scribner's. He's going there where he's going to make it. He is not going to make it as a writer with all his talent.
And there's a conversation in Music for Chameleons where he's having a conversation with Marilyn Monroe, and he leaks out one of the secrets. It's like, you know, he's 19 and he has an affair with Errol Flynn. You know, like he's just such a name dropper. Like everything. And then afterwards he tells Marilyn, he's like, how was he? He's like, it was not memorable. I don't remember anything about it. If it hadn't been Errol Flynn, I wouldn't remember it at all.
The name. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Errol Flynn has escaped oblivion. Even a 25-year-old probably has heard of Errol Flynn. I don't know.
Maybe.
Right. Yeah. Maybe.
I know they tried to make a movie with him, about him, with Kevin Kline, but I never saw it. I don't know if it's any good.
Right. Well, the great story about Errol Flynn is that Hemingway and Martha Gellhorn and George Orwell and Dos Passos and all these people are in Madrid, and Errol Flynn comes in and gets off his airplane, and there's cameras popping and everything all over the place, and he gives a couple of speeches and about how, you know, help is going to come, etc., and he just gets on the plane and just flies away onto San Moritz or Monaco or somewhere, you know?
That's actually very beautiful. It's like, it removes all the pretensions. Like, no, I'm just here to be an actor for this one speech, and then I'm done.
No, and actually everybody kind of said, it was so blatant. Yeah. That it was, who else but Errol Flynn, man? Yeah, we'll just stop off on Madrid, which is being bombed right now, and give a speech, and then we'll go on to Monaco, and where I can find, you know, some little Neapolitan boys. Oh, my Lord, man. Yeah, the whole thing of fame and who's going to be famous and who's going to be known, and I talk about a lot I came in here in 1988, where there were all these writers that were so famous, right? And they're gone, and they've been gone for 20 years.
Yeah.
And they were like,
But famous regionally, more or less.
no, there are a few. The only one that seems to keep holding on is Alice Hoffman. And some, but she got into the magic thing. She kind of went into like, into kind of magical stuff and witches and doing stuff. And that, again,
I could see getting
hit.
being an Aleister Crowley myself, wearing a bejeweled hat and convincing everyone I'm a
But
demon.
Alice Hoffman was a bona fide Southern female writer.
Okay.
And in the 80s and serious, and then all of a sudden all her books have either magic in them or somewhere, and but she's still being published, and she's probably 80 now, But yeah, how do you stay in the mainstream of fame in America? It's like, how do you stay a fish in the feeding grounds of a nice river and not just kind of like drift off to the side, right?
Well, it's like you have to eventually, right? I mean, you get enough fame for enough time. It's like
Well,
there's
Capote,
probably a natural.
people keep reading Capote, man. I mean,
Well, he's just
he's so
good.
good. He's so good. And
I mean, I would recommend Music for Chameleons over all of his other books, frankly. I mean,
thank you for saying this
yeah.
because my compadre Jonah did not read Hand Carved Coffins, which is the true crime creative nonfiction right in the middle of Music for Chameleons, that is the finest piece of writing, narrative nonfiction I've ever read, man. Just, and it's more of a novella, which helps it. But no, it's absolutely spectacular, man. Music for Chameleons is a classic. It's one of the great books of all time, and it's always gonna. And it's mainly nonfiction, and even the short stories have this element of nonfiction to them.
Well, I think they're
So
also.
he basically just got rid of the framing of fiction and just using his notoriety and his access to people, just started like, bingo, man, I'm just going to put myself in a situation where there's going to be a story, and just does it. But with that, I have to say, we all enter these stories every moment of our lives, but Truman writes them, and they have these, I mean, a couple of these stories are only like 5 or 6, 10 pages. Could he sell these to a magazine? No. But he's Truman Capote, so boom, he's
Yeah,
got it,
right.
right?
Yeah.
But I have to say that Hand Carved Coffins is the greatest Western story ever. And it's not even mentioned as that, but
Well, it's got this weird FBI guy who,
right. Who calls him
yeah.
because of his notoriety
Yeah.
and says, "Hey, I got a story you can't believe."
Yeah.
And I'm not in the position politically or legally to tell you what it is.
And it's hard to get a handle on whether this guy's a phony or not. Because by the end, he's halfway convinced that this high up sort of Mormon, the murderer, who he thinks is the
Rancher.
murderer, the
Rancher,
rancher,
yeah.
who he thinks is the murderer, then his wife dies in a tragic drowning accident, and he has this ability to say, well, my wife and her sister crossed across his land at that time, and maybe he had saw them doing it, and saw it as a perfect opportunity to drown my wife. And it's so ambiguous towards the end because and I think that's what makes it good as a crime story, is because there's
Yeah.
that lingering ambiguity to it.
Right, except for the last line. When, again, Capote's got this way of saying, did you do this? And this rancher, who's the classic 6'3, raw boned, hard working his whole life, silver hair and flashing blue eyes, and he says he looks out over the land and the river that has been dry and dry, and he said it was an act of God. Truman is great with the last line, man.
That's it. Sorry, I'm just going to check the source here real fast.
Yeah.
Just
for yeah, read the last. Here, I'll read it.
Oh.
I get to, because it's so good.
Yeah.
I nodded. Somebody told me he was leaving the Bureau. Yes, he's going to live in Oregon. Oh, no, that was a rancher saying, somebody told me he was leaving
the Bureau. I thought you were just going to read the last monologue.
Right, I did too, but... And then Capote says, yes, he's going to live in Oregon. Well, I don't guess I'll ever see that old bastard again. Too bad. We could have been real friends if he hadn't all those suspicions. Damn his soul. He even thought I drowned poor Addie Mason. He laughed, then scowled. The way I look at it is, it was the hand of God. He raised his own hand, and the river, viewed between his spread fingers, seemed to weave between them like a dark ribbon. God's work, his will.
You know, you picked up more of the imagery of that than I did, I think, because for me, when I read it, I was, I think maybe I missed that a little bit. I missed the menacing sociopathic essence of it, you know, like.
But what's so interesting, so gentle listener, you got to read this, because this rancher has land on one of the tributaries of the Arkansas or the Platte River in Colorado. And the people decide they're going to dam the river upstream of him, and it's going to be good for everybody. It's going to be a win-win situation. There's going to be a reservoir for people to boat in, and there'll be electricity and da-da-da, and we'll be able to have developments, and we're going to do all this stuff. And again, just as a little postscript, this is what's crazy about Capote. Capote can get your sympathy for the devil.
You have
in
to.
In subtle ways. I mean, you have to.
That's what I appreciate about
he
him.
He does it. Yeah, yeah. He does it. And anyway, just this is my memory. I didn't reread it. When Jonah brought the book in, I didn't even reread it. It's so vivid in my mind.
Which this says is, a lot in and of itself.
Exactly. So this is all like Shakespeare, man. And this is kind of in the background, but I don't think Capote starts with it. He just says that the FBI agent calls him and says, well, you know, so-and-so. It was kind of like there's a movie called The List of Adrian Messenger, which it's a classic mystery technique of one person dies, then another person dies, and then another person dies, and the sleuth has got to figure out what is the common denominator that links them all together, right? And so the first one is, it's a hot summer day in the southern Colorado Rockies, and this guy goes out after he's been working all day, and his car's been sitting in the sun. And he gets in his car and shuts it and turns on the ignition before he realizes that his car is full of Western Diamondback rattlesnakes who bite him to a fault. And for some reason, somebody with a certain amount of professionalism just decides, well, we're just going to test these creatures to see, you know, and they find high amounts of amphetamines. So
in the creatures.
In the rattlesnakes. So these rattlesnakes have not only just made their own way up into this car, they have been jazzed with amphetamines just to put them on a little more edge.
Does that work?
Well, it worked in this case.
Okay.
Because the guy got bit like 65 times died.
That's an amazing detail, though. It's like filling rattlesnakes with amphetamines. What the fuck?
Well, in our next podcast, Jonah will be able to recount that actually Will made that up because it made such a better story.
It's beautiful. I don't want to second guess.
And it fits with our earlier Pocatello story, right? About West Side amphetamine use and therapeutics, so to speak, in Pocatello. And yeah, so that's one. And then the other one is the guy loves to ride a motorcycle, and he's going down the road, and someone has strung a piano wire across the road at the exact perfect level at the exact time of day when nobody else is going to come through there. In other words, knowing this guy and his habits takes his head off. So that's two.
That which is also a plot point in Cormac McCarthy's movie, The Counselor.
Really?
That exact scene happens in The Counselor.
Well, he got it from, because he's from, he knows Southwick. He got it from Truman.
Yeah, he must have.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's just one of the most brilliant pieces of work I've ever known. And again, as you say, Truman never says anything. And the FBI agent leaves town, and the rancher goes on with his life, right? Nothing has changed, man. But you know, at the end, it's the hand of God. Right. Oh, it's such a great book. Oh, man. When I read that, I was convinced that Truman Capote was probably better than anybody, you know, in the later 20th century. And what was so horrible about it is he'd keep, you know, going on Johnny Carson and just made a fool of, you know, and he was, I mean, he was so... He was so gay, man. And I know that he tried to be that. I mean, I think he made his voice even flutterier than he had to, man.
Well, that's a classic, thing. It's like most gay men, it's not natural for them to talk that way.
Right,
It's an affectation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and to be turned into just, again, we're going to go back to this theme about media, right? But what's so astonishing about Capote was that, I mean, Hemingway was pretty much ruined by fame and money. Mailer.
Sort of liked it.
Everybody.
Mailer was all right. Mailer did all right with it.
And Hunter S. Thompson, fuck, he was destroyed by it. I mean, he never wrote anything after, of any real evenness.
Let me just finish that
Capote went on, was the staple... a laughingstock of America in the late 60s on Johnny Carson and all these shows. And he kept, like, writing really good stuff, you know? Isn't that interesting, right?
It is.
Because he knew what he was doing. He knew he was playing the clown. He knew he was, you know, what he was. And I think that's a really important part about writing. I mean, he knows what he's doing when he's writing, man. You know, what's your effect? What are you going to do? But yeah, my memories of Capote. I mean, I saw him on Capote and be just as a clown. And then 10 years later, 20 years later, I start reading his stuff and I'm going, man, this is like really good stuff.
Well, you know, it's I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, the way he was tortured by it, and he definitely paved the way for somebody like David Sedaris.
Oh yeah.
Who I enjoy now. Like, I read his book Naked, and that was one of the David Sedaris's book Naked, and that's one of the few pleasurable experiences I had last year, was just like reading Naked, because it's all just fun. It's this nonfiction, but it's still got this character style to it. And in his introduction, he has this awareness of doing something new that I feel, I don't know quite how to feel about. I don't know if it's an affectation or if it's true, but he gives this introduction where he talks about the essence of, I was trying to combine every version of writing that exists into a single form. Which, in a certain sense, I'm really sympathetic to, because it's like, well, yeah, you look back on these old, you know, short stories, which are specific to a form, to a function. You look back on novels specific to a form or a function, nonfiction, reportage, and all of his stuff in Music for Chameleons does seem to combine all of those things at the same time. Which, I don't know if he's being a little performative or disingenuous, but I don't know. I
thought, Sedaris.
No, Capote.
Capote.
In Capote's introduction, yeah.
Oh, I didn't. Oh, I thought you were talking about Sedaris' introduction.
No, 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 sorry.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah, right. Right. So Sedaris never said that about his book.
No, no. Right, not as far as I'm aware. I mean, I'm sure he probably
Right, did, but and we know Sedaris read that introduction. And it enabled him to write better.
Probably.
Obviously. Yeah.
Probably. I mean, I wouldn't doubt it at all. Although, it's maybe it's one of those things where it's so heavily influenced him that, you know, it's almost he doesn't want to go there because he's like, well, this is exactly the way I want to write. So, well, who knows? I don't know. But
yeah, I've been reading Murakami, and man, it's...
Which one now?
This one is Hard-Boiled Wonderland and the End of the World. And I mean, it's so fantastic because, yeah, it takes this wisdom of non-framing and just developing a rapport with the reader, you know, that is disingenuous. But at the same time, it's awfully easy to read. And he's not getting in a hurry. And he's got his cards, you know, he's got cards waiting to play, you know. So I mean, it's really nice. It's, yeah, you have a an agreement with the writer. Yeah, just make it easy to read and listen to your voice, and I'm going to see some good cards here, you know. It's going to be fun, right?
Well, this is your betting days. It's not necessarily that. He's the dealer, and you're the one that's sitting next to him. You're like, all right, I know I'm going to get some good cards.
I'm
going to get something I can play with here.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. You just know it, because Murakami will do it. And then couple of pages, man, it's like, man, this is really crazy. And he hides them really good. But yeah, there's definitely that... I think it's the 21st century style, man. It's like, and I think you're right. I think Capote opened it up. So it's like, no frames, man. I'm going to ask this lady that cleans my house whether I can just accompany her. And it's so good that you think, well, God, he's not taking a microphone along with him.
No.
He's not recording this.
Right.
You know he's not, man.
Yeah.
It's just art, man. It's just...
Yeah.
His ability to pay attention
to
what's happening, man. And of course, the other reason doesn't have a microphone is that he's so stoned halfway through it, man. You know, it's like, hell, man.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so glorious.
Well, he's got that beautiful moment, and there, I was so surprised how much, it was probably a decade ago, I think the Truman Capote movie, it was just called Capote, came out in like 2005 with Philip Seymour Hoffman, who was, you know, sort of an actor of a generation.
I mean,
he was great. And, but he's got a line in that where he's like, I have a 94% recall of all conversation. And obviously that's at play in a lot of these things. It's, you know, just being able to be in the moment, yet still recall everything in your head. And it's like, but he there's also an interview with himself at the end of the book where he talks about, you know, it's like he can't subtract. Like, he literally doesn't understand how to subtract things. Like, he's terrible at algebra. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like he fails in so many ways, but he has like a 94% recall of everything.
But the other thing is that he not only lives in the now, and all you young writers out there that are listening, he's not only in the now, he's thinking, I'm going to get back and I'm going to write everything I remember when I get back, either tonight or tomorrow morning, I'm not going to let a day go by that I don't just like get something on paper.
That's
because
true.
As you know, 2 or 3 days goes by, boom, you think, oh, I'll do it. And then you don't, you know, and then it's gone.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
Oh God, a day's work is just such of how in such a minimal piece he can get such a slice, the cliche, slice of American life. This is real, man.
Yeah.
This is real. And the French power sociologist can look at it and go, oh yeah, you know, I get this. I mean, anybody can. It's just like, boom, so perfect, so tone perfect. And then again, not a word out of place. And, you know, I've read Tom Wolfe's Hallucinogenic Journeys, and I've read Kerouac's in Electric Kool-Aid.
Electric Kool-Aid.
And I've read a lot of people describing being really stoned, and this is the best description of being really stoned I've ever heard, man. I mean, it's like, and we all want to know where this stuff in Peru comes from, man. I mean, I was thinking vaguely about it. Where am I going to get this stuff? Yeah.
How can I be feeling like I'm on a beach in Australia? Surfing. And I mean, it's like a...
I know.
It's super good high. Well, but I mean, he was also such a performer, you know. And there's always that undercurrent of writers is like, writer is a quasi-performer, you know. When I was younger, I got pretty convinced that being a good writer wasn't just about sentence structure. It was also about being an interesting person, you know. And I think that's part of the performance aspect of it is...
Is that why nobody likes my writing?
Well, you're an interesting person, but you also...
I have no I learned from Flaubert. You suppress all that. You know, I was thinking of that, Jonah. My two greatest influences are Basho, 17th century Japanese haiku writer.
Why? Okay.
And Flaubert. And it's just like this.
Why is Basho one of your most influential?
Because it's such beautiful, just beautiful condensed imagery that is, doesn't have the least personality. It only has this kind of transcendent mind behind it, you know.
Uh-huh.
Oh, the one about the dew on the grass and where all the warriors have died in battle or lain in, but he doesn't say it that way. Basho says it totally different. And the image of grass and warriors laying underneath the grass, right? You know, I say it like that. Basho says it like 10 times a magnitude more beautifully than that. How does he do it? Just with simple little inversions of the phrase. And but yeah, so anyway, that's just not, man, performing is just not in my God, that's why I love to write, man. There's no,
but that's when you started doing, you memorized poems and stuff and you performed them in the bookstore and stuff.
But writing, what I love so much about writing, and I write, as you know, I write 5 days a week like you do, and what I love about it is, man, I am just totally in another world, and there's no performance aspect to it. And unless it's the characters, I love the performance aspects of the characters, which is a really, thank you for asking this. I really love it when I think I've got a scene where the character is a performer, sociologically or sociopathically. And I'm just going to try and bring out that performer in him. You know, I do like that. I do like that a lot.
Yeah. Then that seems very Tool, or John Tool.
Right.
Of like,
right.
I mean, I could see a lot of crossover between your work and his work, because his work also has a fuck ton of dialogue. I mean, fucking 90% of Confederacy of Dunces is dialogue, which really bogs me down. I mean, I gotta say, I don't know. I mean, it's fun, and it's like, it's these characters talking, and but...
But you realize, Jonah, from now on, my next blurb on my novel, a fuck ton of dialogue, Jonah Andrus, author of The Sea Slug. I'm going to use this to my advantage. Yeah. Well, that's true. That's true. He loses the... No, I grant this to you. Yes, you're absolutely right. When you do that, you lose the performative voice of the narrator.
Yes.
No doubt about it. And that, you lose a certain amount of drive that only the narrator can do, because he's a storyteller.
Right. And there's always a part of the reader, I think, that wants to know, okay, but who are you?
Right.
You know, it's like, yeah, we can listen to these characters for a while, and they're all pretty amusing, but right. Still, at the end of the day, and it's a side effect. I don't even know. Well, I've got to bring up Kundera.
Yes, of course.
I got to hit the quota.
Yes. I'm gonna get a little picture of Milan, and I'm gonna put it so every time you mention him. If you're new to this podcast, gentle listener, there has not been one podcast where we have not brought up Milan Kundera. But I'm gonna put it on the stovepipe there, and we're just, and after he says it totally spontaneously, I'm gonna get up and just pat Milan on the forehead.
Maybe
and
get a little bell on his nose that can tingle.
Yeah, just like, ting, boop, ting, boop. Ting, ting. Yeah. So, as Milan would say. Oh, no.
No. That's a pedo. That's the least.
So, as Milan would say, what?
Well, I was going to talk about immortality.
Right. In reference to what we're talking about, the performative.
Yeah. Actually, I lost it a little bit. Milan would not be proud, but he would understand.
Oh, absolutely. He was the most performative of the writers, yeah. He's front and center every moment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's mainly his thing of, you know, at the end of Immortality, where it's like, you know, especially the modernists, where they hid their lives behind their prose, right?
Right.
So then it takes another generation of scholars to deconstruct
right.
what the lives were behind the prose they were portraying to the public.
Right.
But what would have been more interesting in the first place? Just telling your life? You know, it's like maybe that would have been the more honest way to approach it in the first place. You know, instead of hiding it behind a variation of characters who do or do not signify your life. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It's hard to tell, you know. So then some scholar has to break it down and give a long-winded introduction. Like I have recently been listening to with Catherine Mansfield.
Really?
Yes. Who seems specifically of her time, and I don't dislike her at all. It's just really...
She was one of the greatest short story writers of all time.
I don't know if I can agree with you.
I haven't read her in a long time, but, you know, man, it all fits together. The life fits together, right? I mean, you know, does it fit together? Does it fit together on a piece? And this is an important question, that would you rather read a beautiful lie or a fairly boring truth, right?
Well, I feel like there needs to be at least a third option.
Well, there is, and going back to Capote, I think Capote really, you know, opened the ground for just showing how really spectacular creative nonfiction can be without any, artificial framing or genre placing, right?
Well, and also you let off this whole conversation with that framing is, oh my god, what was that beautiful word you used? Framing is, it starts with a D. Yeah.
Duplicitous? Delusory?
those are both good, too.
Yeah,
yes. Those are both good, too.
Exactly so. But yeah, but then when you do the, like you said, when you do, you loved Sedaris's book, when you do a book that is, like, just real and it's really, it all holds together and it's wonderful, yeah. And yeah, Capote does that. yes, and that's what's so interesting about writing in the first person is that here I've been stuck, I've been, for 15 years, I've been writing, you know, this huge novel in the first person, which is even more blatantly false because it's actually saying, yeah, actually, this is first person, right? So it's actually better to write in the third person because then your lie is not quite so disingenuous, right?
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly so.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's another one of those cliches that they teach in creative writing, which is, you know, stray away from the first person. Which, just like the fucking dialogue, 25% dialogue, 75% description, that's something they teach you in creative writing classes. And unfortunately, I'm in agreement with. It's like, yeah, maybe in general you should start with third person, you know,
right,
because
right.
It just gives you more options, really. You know?
Right. Yeah, and we're all talking about how do we make it easier for the reader, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, so you'll be very proud of me. I've been reading M.H. Abrams, and he divides it between mimesis.
Mimesis.
Thank you. Which I like to write, and the expressive and the objective theories, and of course, in 1950, pragmatic reader response. I mean, Sedaris. Everybody's gonna like Sedaris. It's so easy to read. Everybody's going to like Capote. It's so easy to read. I mean, reader response, pragmatic, you know, the pragmatic approach to doing art is all in your favor if you do the pragmatic reader response, man. I mean, Capote is making it so easy for you. Sedaris is making it so easy for you. But I have to say that, you know, Faulkner doesn't make it easy for you at all, man.
Yeah.
And neither does Shakespeare. I mean, none of the really great ones make it easy for you.
Well, Shakespeare had
And you know why? Because you can never go to the absolute sublime if you are playing within these realms of making it easy on the reader.
Yeah,
it's just never going to happen, man.
Right.
Because you do have, and again, I mean, I confess, yeah. I mean, Shakespeare's greatest play probably is Macbeth. Why? Because, boom, it's like reader response every minute. I mean, like, he's like, every scene is like, boom. You're not going to wait 1 second to find out what Lady Macbeth is going to tell Macbeth to do now, man. You know, it's like, boom, 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 boom. And it goes all the way through there. You know, is that his greatest play? Well, it's the easiest one to read, right? But you're never going to get into, you know, these fantastic emotional things of Hamlet, right? Or King Lear, you know, and all this madness and all this humanity, right? I've just noticed that. So, yeah, I mean, you go between, okay, the humanity of David Sedaris, or the humanity of somebody that you yourself or me or Shakespeare really loved and was trying to bring out, right? And so there are a lot of different reasons to write, man. And I'm just, you know, I will give you all the arguments that you have and I have as well. But I still like to write so that, man, I'm just getting into this really weird territory here, man. I'm just really enjoying it, man. It's just like great. I mean, if nobody reads this, really, I don't care, man, because I've really nobody's paying me 50 cents to come into my show, you know. So I'm just going to write. And anyway, there's always that, man.
And I have to appreciate, you know, a man now 70 who's still reading literary criticism. I mean, you could probably not say the same thing for most academics.
You know what really happened bad in this? This is David Lodge, who wrote two or three novels.
Okay.
Placed himself very well. What I'm really pissed... Oh, God, the Yeats on symbolism is, like, unbelievable, man. I mean, this guy is as elitist as it gets. You can't believe it.
Well, my favorite quote from Yeats is... and that is... It's fairly pretentious, but... You know, Yeats was a doctor, right? So he's going to medical school and he drops out and he says... You know, I've decided I no longer want to fix men's bodies. I want to fix men's souls.
Yes, yes. And right, and how do you do that? By symbolism. Anyway, what I read, so the next one was Freud. And I always kind of supported Freud a little bit because he was able to say that, you know, life is really a struggle and you're going to suffer, right? Uh-huh. But creative writers and daydreaming is the most philistine, pathetic fallacy that I've ever read, in which he just tries to support all the way through there, you know. And his concept of creative work is like...
Oh, I think that's an interesting question, though, because it's still very much in the air to me. Because people use these words like creativity and imagination, and half the time I don't know what the fuck they're talking about. I mean, more than half the time, I don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Right. But he equates writing, Shakespeare. Okay, let's just link ourselves with Shakespeare, right? Or Homer.
All right. Well,
No harm in that.
It's always good podcast fodder to link yourself with Shakespeare.
Let's just ally ourselves with the great writers. Freud's discussion in this is, and it just shows what a basically mediocre human being he was, is that having, of course, he could not read Shakespeare in the original, but he's saying that being a writer is basically some kind of wish fulfillment of the ego of where I get to be, you know, Errol Flynn. Right.
Hmm.
So here he takes...
It is sometimes, though. I've met people like that.
Of course we have.
Yeah.
The lowest form of literature is what Freud's talking about.
Yeah.
And this is the basic fallacy of the false alternative, where, okay, he builds an old essay about being a writer is wish fulfillment, infantile wish fulfillment, right? And you're just going... Man, this is pretty chicken shit, Siggy. You know? And it's true, man. Jeez, this guy's really got a... Of course, everybody's got their bad days.
That's true.
You know, and this was his bad day. David Lodge picked this as his bad day, man. You're just going, man, what a chicken shit little fucker, man. When writing is just how you just try to get hold of all the mysteries of being alive and... God, man, it's so glorious, and relating it, oh, man, I couldn't believe it. So, yeah, it was a big, bad day for me, man. Here I've been defending Sigmund Freud for, like, 70 years, and...
Fuck. Well, I still think you should. I mean, compared to the modern way that most people interpret him, I feel like, yeah, you should get into his corner, in general.
Well, I thought I should. I thought I should because everybody was kicking him around.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No, now I'm thinking he deserves it. Don't piss Will off, man. People know this.
Well, I mean, it's unfair and fair simultaneously. It's
Well, in terms of what we're talking about, Freud, then?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I don't know.
Oh, man, that is just so... I mean, that's only one-fifth. Granted, I mean, I mean, the point is made. And you talk about, now that we're on the artifice of writing and how Capote dispenses of it,
yeah,
and Sedaris dispenses of it, there's no doubt that Hemingway used the heroic male, right, to frame these stories. But look, he gives you the Spanish Civil War. He gives you World War I in Spoleto, in northern Italy.
I'm sorry. He gives you, I just had like a...
But I'm just saying that he gives you all this through this framework. Okay, go ahead.
So I had a brain spasm, which said to me, perhaps what writers do then is engage precisely with the opposite of wish fulfillment. Capote going to murderers, mystery stories, the basest, the greatest, the worst parts of humanity. And this is what we're interested in exploring, like, truly. We're like, okay, so what is the dark secrets that lurk underneath the frilly facade of social function? Well, okay, there's one sense, which is wish fulfillment, which is boosting me up. But to do the opposite of that, mm-hmm, which is to engage with the absolute worst parts of it.
This is why I hang out with you, Jonah. This is the real stuff, man. This is exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, I gotta work that out more, though.
No, it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. It has no justification in Freudian wish fulfillment, man. It's, like, ridiculous. And it's demeaning.
Well, I'm saying it's the reverse of that.
That's what I'm saying.
Which makes it both true and untrue at the same time.
How does it make it true? Well, what Freud said.
Right. Well, because I have met a lot of writers who are doing that. Who are chasing some kind of wish. Of recognition, of I was going to repeat myself in that last sentence. Of, they're chasing some idea of social standard that they will then have by doing this action. That is a certain subset of writers. It's true. Freud's not wrong about that. There is a certain subset of writers that do that.
Right, but that's not really what Freud's talking about. Freud is actually talking about there is a certain life force, erotic projection or sublimation into the storytelling format in which the male is greater or wins the woman or wins the battle, right?
Okay, well, yeah, that's bullshit.
That's pretty much what he's talking about.
But that's not, yeah.
Well, no, I think, I'm glad you misunderstood, because you made a really good point, man. Capote knows what writing's all about. Let's just get into the real mystery, right? What the heck's going on here, man? Has nothing to do with the wish fulfillment. It has totally to do with just the human spirit and the courage of the human spirit to, I hate to use the word existentially, but I am, to without repayment. There is no repayment, man, for going in. Are you kidding me, man? He goes into San Quentin and to just try to understand something, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that is so noble to me.
I completely
And Freud agree. Is like just saying this is what writers do. I mean, I was just so disgusted I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying.
But Freud was also well known for his writing, and he obviously wrote a lot. So, I mean, how he can separate himself from quote-unquote writers is, to me, weird.
Well, yeah, that too, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But he's taking the stance of the scientist, right?
Right.
And so already that is, I mean, you talk about disingenuous, man. I mean, that's so disgusting, man. Any great doctor. My dad was a doctor, man. That's what is so glorious about him, man. He was so, so humble intellectually, man. And, man, he got down into his hands in the blood, man. His whole life was nothing but blood. His life was nothing but blood. Nobody was humbler than he was, sweeter than he was. Yeah,
His life was nothing but blood.
His life was nothing but blood.
That needs
man.
To be a chapter title for
your... Well, you know, my son said, you ought to write about your dad. I said, well, I don't know enough about it, but that in a capsule is what he did, man. Cut people apart and delivered babies. But that's just the easy part. But now you're talking about human beings, man. I think that's...
You know, I agree with your son. I feel like that would be a worthwhile endeavor.
Oh, yeah.
If not just for a short story or something like that.
Oh, you know, I don't know. Just that's what's great to talk about it because, yeah, in a capsule, that's basically it, you know, and that was part of his humility and his sweetness was that amount of struggle and blood, right? And to call this wish fulfillment is like fucking horrible, man. I mean, or you become a doctor so you can have power. It's like, fuck, well, a lot of people do, right? And a lot of people become writers for that. But I mean, these are all just chaff, you know. These are just all losers, man. We don't even worry about them, man.
Yeah, yeah.
So for Freud to write a whole essay about creativity from the, you know, dealing with only losers, you know, it's like, it's totally dishonest. And
well, it is dishonest, but it's dishonest in the right way, in my opinion, because, well, I mean, there is a lot more to explore, in my opinion, about what creativity is, because it's not clear cut. It's not particularly understandable, even. I mean, most people, when they realize you're involved in a creative endeavor, they don't know where you're even at, you know, or there are people who pretend to creativity because it's supposed to be the beautiful way to make their life beautiful. I don't know. Maybe that's just something personal I'm struggling with or something, but...
Well, you do bring an interesting point up of beauty. I mean, it's obvious that's a part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually feel that I write beautiful books. I actually think I do.
And there's no reason for you to
It conforms to my aesthetic, right? So beauty is big in there, man. But
this resounds to the fundamental question of, well, what is everyone's aesthetic? You know, it's like everyone has their own aesthetic of some kind, but what is the aesthetic that crosses all boundaries?
Well, there's none. I mean, Disneyland, R. Kelly, you know, who gives a fuck, man? You know, once you are a writer, that's what's so glorious about it being a bookseller is I talk to people every day who are involved in the glory and the beauty of literature. I mean, and they're all young. You know, a few old people come in here and buy books about, you know, sinking Soviet ships and da 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 da. But and history and right. But most people are in most people now that I meet are like, they're young. They're just into the glory and the mystery of being human beings. You know, and it goes through, you know, apocalyptic literature or fantasy or whatever, but basic 19th century, the train of 19th century, 18th century, 19th century literature, not too many people are into that, you know, and that's what you and I are into, and so this is our fate, you know, and but no, there are always people. I mean, the human spirit is always, like Faulkner said, you know, the human soul in conflict with itself, man. And it's just like this mystery of life, and it happens in literature, man. It happens in poetry and short stories, but a materialist scientist can never get that. You know, it just can't do it. The losers can't get anything, man. Zombies. I see Freud now as kind of a mini zombie in a way, man. He's like... He's found his little fucking strata of power.
He's not alive. How can he have power? He's not alive. How do you have power?
He's lost a lot of it. He's definitely lost a lot of it through feminism and a lot of it. It's been a hard week for me. I've suffered after reading that, man. I always try to defend. It's just like there's a kid in high school that you always try to, you know, say, well, he's kind of a dickhead, but he does have cigarettes, you know, occasionally. So, right? And he did give me a beer. And he just say hi to me on the street, right? And they think, man, this guy's a real dickhead. And I'm thinking, yeah, actually, Sigmund Freud is kind of a dickhead, man. It's really been a crushing fall for me. But I can live with it somehow.
Yeah, somehow. Somehow. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think Nabokov is up in the clouds somewhere, still duking it out with Freud, being like, yeah, we'll see who lasts longer, motherfucker.
Good finish, man. That was a nice 20-footer, man. Just right through it. Yeah. Absolutely so, man.
Right.
Yeah. Great. So, we got anything else to
throw the beer bottle at?
Oh, God. Thank you. Yeah. That was a nice return. Yeah. To going under the underpass in Spokane. I love Spokane, man. Spokane is a big Pocatello. But the one thing I like about Spokane is they have summer concerts and they play nothing but rhythm and blues. It's all black music, man. Spokane's probably the only black city in the Rocky Mountains. All the rest of them are either yuppified or, you know. But I've had a lot of fun in Spokane every time I went there.
Yeah. It's
and that river is spectacular, man. Did you walk along the river?
Yeah.
God, man. I can't believe nobody's ever done a thriller there where a guy just gets rid of one person after another by saying, hey, let's go walk along the river, man. Yeah.
No, this is the writer's engagement with mystery. It's not just mystery in its cosmic sense. It's literal, the literal mystery of individuals disappearing.
Right, right. Spokane is the most spectacular city in America for setting. I mean, you're not going to have like 5 miles of 100-foot waterfalls with a big river. I mean, I was just astounded every time I'd go there. Of course,
We pulled in there, and we pulled into just a gas station, and I walked out, and there was a girl huddled in a blanket on the corner against the gas station, and I walked up near her and I lit a cigarette, and she looks up at me and she says, can you drive me to the Conoco? And I said, I don't know where that is. And she told me she didn't know where that was either. And I was like, well, I guess we're kind of at an impasse then. It's kind of the place. It's got some wildlife. It's got some wildlife.
But at least she's honest. Yeah. What a great ending to this story. Another podcast. You have been listening to Western Thought. And this would be the last day of summer, 2021.
Doop-a-doop-doop-doop. That was a fist bump.